Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, we examine the history of labor unions and how they have shaped America today. But first, does power breed hypocrisy? After a decade of ethics scandals, psychologists began to wonder, does power breed hypocrisy? That became the subject of a psychological study that looked at why powerful people, those who often speak in highly moral language, don't always do as they say. The study found that, in fact, there is a correlation between power and hypocrisy, whereby the powerful people hold others to high moral standards, but they tend to go easy on themselves. We have one of the authors of this study, Adam Galinsky, with us. Adam Galinsky is a professor of ethics and decision making in management at the School of Management at Northwestern University. Welcome, Adam Galinsky.
Thank you so much.
Well, it's great to have you with us. You found that power and influence themselves can cause what you called a severe disconnect between public judgment and private behavior.
Absolutely. That's what we found. Well, we found two sort of main effects in our studies, which I think are important. The first is that power leads people to act in an immoral or unethical way. And so what we found in our studies is that those people who were randomly assigned to experimental conditions in which they had power in our experiments were more likely to cheat in games, were more likely to say that it was okay to fudge expenses, a number of different things. And so one of the key things that this research shows is that although there are more eyes on the powerful, ironically, the powerful feel psychologically invisible, and that then licenses them to act in all of these immoral ways. You could think of power as very much like the Ring of Gyges of Plato, which is popularized in The Lord of the Rings, like exactly what Gollum and Frodo were after, was this cloak of invisibility that then unleashed all of this selfish, self-interested, you know, behavior. But that doesn't make them hypocrites. That just makes them immoral. What makes the powerful hypocrites is they simultaneously hold others to higher standards than they hold for themselves.
Now, I wonder if this would have some explanation to the historic Stanford prison experiment where they randomly assigned students to be prison guards or prisoners, and the prison guards really got abusive.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a contemporary explanation of that. These Stanford undergraduates were randomly assigned to the role of either prisoners or guards. The guards abused their power, tended to almost torture the people, act in ways that satisfied whatever their self-interests were, and then held these people to a very narrow band of acceptable behavior of the prisoners.
You found also that this phenomenon depends somewhat on a sense of legitimacy or illegitimacy. What did you mean by that?
We know why the powerful act immorally, right, is because they feel psychologically invisible. It's like this, you know, cloak of invisibility that licenses them to act in a way that satisfies their self-interest. The reason why the powerful hold higher standards for others, I think, is two mechanisms. The first is it's a way to control other people's behavior, right? If the powerful can hold other people to high standards and punish them when they deviate from them, that's one mechanism they can hold onto their power. Mm. The second thing is that they feel, in some sense, as in their position of authority, that that's what they're supposed to do, that's what they're legitimated to do, right, is to hold standards and structures of authority for other people. And so we found in our studies that when people are in positions of power, but they were concerned about the legitimacy of their position or whether they truly deserved it, then we saw some of this hypocrisy start to disappear. And in fact, we saw, in some ways, ironically, the reverse, where the powerful became harder on themselves than they were on others in states of illegitimacy.
You talked a little bit in your study about a sense of entitlement.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if, in fact, the sense of entitlement came first or if it came later.
Meaning, so whether people have a sense of entitlement and act immorally achieve positions of power, or whether power causes them to have a sense of entitlement and act immorally?
That, as well as the sense of power leading to the sense of entitlement leading to the immoral behavior. What comes first, the chicken or the egg?
Yeah, I think it's a complicated thing. I think that for the first question, we know that at least power has some causal force in this because we took people in the lab, randomly assigned them to either a powerful or powerless role, and saw dramatic changes in the standards they imposed on others and their own behavior. I think that probably there's a sense that when you put people in the position of power, they do feel entitled, and that entitlement allows them to both act in a way that satisfies their own self-interest, even when it's immoral, such as cheating, and license them to impose strict standards on others.
Now, you mentioned this psychological invisibility, which maybe it's not invisibility so much as accountability is my guess.
Absolutely.
A little less invisible, a little more accountable. What explains this hypocrisy element?
I think part of the hypocrisy element is just two different forces going in opposite directions. And humans are rationalization, justification machines. We are very good at rationalizing things. And people in power, I think, don't notice that there is this disconnect between the standards they impose on others and their own behavior. I'm sure they have lots of justification reasons why it made sense for me to cheat in this case for these reasons, but that doesn't mean that I'm really acting in a violation of these standards. And I think something else you said before, which is very, very important, which is the word accountability. And that comes the solution to this problem. I think the reason why the powerful act in such hypocritical ways is especially when they're not being held accountable for their behavior. And research on corporate governing boards, boards of directors show that they fail very often in fulfilling their fiduciary duty, which is to serve a control mechanism for CEOs. We see this throughout the world with governments when there's a check on the balance, either through the judiciary or legislator on presidential or prime minister activities, then we see less abusive behavior. So one of the key solutions of our research, I think, is to say finding ways to make those people, CEOs, presidents, prime ministers, whoever it is, to feel accountable and therefore have to explain and justify their behavior, I think would lessen this problem.
I was actually going to ask you about political and social implications of this. But as I was thinking about this, we as a society grant power to people all the time. We grant power to our representatives, our presidents. And it is really difficult to have these limitations placed on these because of the amount of power that they have.
Well, I think, power is a central animating force in social life. There's no question about it. And some other research that my colleagues and I have done have said basically hierarchy, right, where some people have more power and some people have less power, is the most common form of social organization in the world, right? And in fact, not just among humans, but among species. And the reason why is that hierarchy solves lots of problems. It solves coordination problems. It solves conflict problems. It gives people incentives to work hard and to motivate performance. And so once we give people power, oftentimes it seems very well deserved because of all of those processes. But you can still have people in positions of power and still hold them accountable. And I think that one of the metaphors I like to use is, how do you turn power into leadership? Well, think about driving a car. Well, what do you need to do to drive a car? Well, you have to press on the gas. You need acceleration to go somewhere. But you also need a steering wheel so you don't crash into things. So what power does, it kind of gives you that pedal, that acceleration, but we need accountability to give people better steering.
Finally, I wanted to talk about the people who didn't have power. And they were much harder on themselves,
yes.
And they were more lenient on others' moral transgressions. Talk about that.
Well, I think a colleague of mine at NYU, John Jost, has written a lot about going back to sort of Marxist theories of false consciousness and talking about this idea of justifying the systems that we're in, even when those systems discriminate against us. And I think, he's shown in a lot of his research that there's a number of psychological processes that low-power people do that conspire to keep them in low power. And I think this is just one of those processes in which the powerless being harder on their own behavior and being more lenient towards others sort of keeps them in a place of subjugation and sort of helps reinforce the social hierarchy.
And so you've got to start to think about how do you resolve that issue as well.
Right. And I think, one of the ways to do that is to also, you want to make people feel empowered who are below, and you want to make people above feel accountable.
It seems like it's this catch-22 as well, where the more power you get, the more you're willing to voice your opinions and the less sensitivity you have to social disapproval gives you more power.
Absolutely. And I think that, one of the irony things of power is that to get power, you have to be a pretty good perspective taker. You have to understand the desires of those with more power. But once you get power, you tend to lose that capacity.
Well, thank you so much, Adam Galinsky, for joining us. When we come back, the history of labor unions and how they have shaped America today. Stay tuned.
If we want to see our world in one piece.
Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Without the unions, America may have been a very different country. The movements brought about compensatory education, unemployment insurance, social security, and workplace safety laws. It's hard to imagine a time before laws prohibited exploitative practices like child labor, endless workdays, and deadly working conditions. But before the labor movements, these were common features of American life. Author Philip Dre has written about the labor union movements in America. It's called There is Power in a Union, the epic story of labor in America. So welcome, Philip Dre.
Thanks for having me.
There are many ways to recount history and account for the factors that have shaped to the present. Yours is through this lens of the struggle between corporations, the workers, and government. Let's look at American history through this lens. Do you see an overall effect of this struggle in constructing the United States as it is today? And if so, how did these labor movements change America?
That's one reason why I wanted to write the book, because I felt that that story had kind of gone by the wayside a little bit in recent years. And of course, in earlier generations, the labor movement was much more of a kind of a front page story. But the labor movement, of course, began really, you know, industrialization itself in America began in the early 19th century. And the labor movement has been something that's been sort of played a role all along and has more or less transformed itself in various ways to kind of keep up with or try to keep up with capital as it itself progressed during the many decades since, say, the 1820s or so. So it's always been there. It's been the force for both economic and social justice. It had the effect at various times sort of neutralizing corporate rapaciousness, shall we say. At other times, say the mid-20th century, it more or less became kind of a big business itself in many ways. So it's taken on many different forms. In my view, it always was, and I learned this in writing the book, that it often was struggling. Rarely was the labor movement really kind of riding high. It almost always had to fight for its very existence.
So in terms of the way it has shaped the United States and the policies of the United States, what were some of these things that have become accepted and maybe even taken for granted that really haven't existed throughout American history and are there because of labor movements?
Well, I think a lot of people give the labor movement credit with helping to create the middle class in America, especially after the Second World War. Labor was always pushing for a kind of normalization of the life of workers and their families, and that was something that was difficult to obtain. You know, corporations tended to think of workers as just cogs who were part of the production process, and so it was up to labor unions to really sort of structure this battle to win more economic security for workers. And so, you know, in many ways, the New Deal, for instance, could be seen as the triumph or the fruition of many decades of labor union agitation and all the benefits that flowed from that, many of which we still enjoy today, whether it's Social Security, unemployment insurance, not to mention all the kind of workaday reforms such as the eight-hour day, vacation pay, health coverage, and the work of, you know, agencies such as OSHA to guarantee worker safety on the job, all these things which we take for granted. None of that was given to the American workers. They had to fight for every bit of it.
You noted that every one of these was really fiercely resisted until it became a standard feature of American life.
In other words, that struggle did, because you go back to the 1840s, unions themselves were considered illegal. They were called conspiracy. And so unions, you know, they had to go to fight in court to be legitimized. Then you had, of course, efforts to paint unions as radical or later as corrupt. Corporations used the courts. They used militia, police, labor spies, Pinkertons, many of which we've seen dramatized in movies like Matewan. So, yes, it was always a struggle, and every step of the way, whether it was something to deal with worker, you know, whether workers' compensation, health on the job, these were fights that had to be waged. It wasn't until the early 20th century that you began to see government start playing a role, and also reformers who insisted on what they then called industrial democracy. And what that was about was corporations finally acknowledging, again, with the sort of nudging of the government, the idea that labor strife wasn't worth the trouble. In other words, that productivity and profits were actually injured or inhibited when labor was resisting. And so there were periods where there was more of an effort made to kind of equalize things and to move forward sort of, you know, hand in hand. So those were the kind of bright moments, in a sense, when you had a sense of cooperation and acknowledgement of workers' needs and so on. And, you know, thankfully, we have had some of those periods. But otherwise, yes, you make a good point that it was almost all these things had to be demanded, fought for, marched over, what have you. And there were many, many really disturbing confrontations.
I'd like to get into those in just a little bit and, in fact, go back to the industrial democracy concept. But before we do that, I want to keep on the general overview first. When you looked across all of these campaigns and that the union effort mobilized, did you see patterns from both the part of the labor movement and the opposition to them? And did you see these patterns changing? Was there something that you saw recurring?
Well, what was interesting to me was the way in which labor would sort of transform itself to meet the particular challenge that capital was then posing. In other words, when you had, for instance, after the Civil War, the rapid growth of the economy as well as the national railroad system, you then had unions begin to realize that they could not remain local in their focus. They would have to become national and regional as well. And so you saw this very quick growth of much larger unions with rank-and-file members all over the country. And when this finally, the nation finally more or less realized this during the Great Rail Strike of 1877, where you basically had the entire rail system of the country shut down by labor unions. And people were stunned. Many people who hadn't really given much heed to organized labor before that were sort of awed at the organizational power of unions to bring something like the railroads to a halt. And up to that point, it had all been this like, well, look, you know, the railroads expanding, you know, nothing can stop us, get out of our way. And once you had the unions sort of flex their muscles as well, it kind of introduced a new day. People, capital, government, everyone, you know, stood back and said, whoa, this is something a little different. And so, you know, there have been those kind of turning points. And then other kind of transitions along the way where corporations would become different, the introduction of the assembly line, for instance, in the early 20th century. Then, too, you had unions kind of alter their tactics. And that goes on even today, where you see organized labor trying to adapt to globalization, for instance, trying to use the internet, ally with human rights organizations or anti-sweatshop leagues. They're always playing catch-up a little bit, but often doing a good job of calibrating their activism to match that of corporations and now transnationals as well.
Another thing that I thought was quite interesting to sort of pull out of your book as almost a separate look is how in each of the chapters you talked about how the presidents or the other leaders in American politics reacted to issues that were labor related. And you started really as far back as Jefferson, Hamilton, and then you went, of course, Abraham Lincoln, who was quite friendly and supportive of labor. I wonder if you could give us sort of a sense of how you feel the political leadership in the United States fit within the rights of working people and worked with any kind of organization that was going on there.
Well, that's an interesting question because that's quite a story in and of itself. I mean, there's always been this kind of pronounced ambivalence, I would say, about the role of government in labor. And overall, the truth is that it took government a very, very long time to decide that it even had a role to play. In other words, for decades, through most of the 19th century, government believed that it really had no business in that at all, and that the relationship between capital and labor should be left on its own, which, of course, after a while, with the growth of large corporations, became ludicrous because you had government and the courts saying, well, we can't interfere when you have a large corporation dealing with an individual worker. They have to figure this out for themselves. But, of course, the might of the large corporations versus the individual worker, it was such an imbalance that only reluctantly did government finally get involved. What you bring up is interesting. Of course, you have originally the founding fathers, of course, were kind of divided. Do we even want to have industry in this country? Then you move on to, like you mentioned, a labor-friendly president like Lincoln. But then later in the 19th century, the presidents would send the federal troops in to quell labor unrest in large northern cities, Chicago and Cleveland and Detroit, this type of thing. It wasn't really until Woodrow Wilson, 1914 or so, that you begin seeing government really deciding that, well, we have some role to play here. They weren't quite sure what it was at first. They would form commissions and boards of inquiry. It wasn't really until the New Deal in the 1930s that you finally had government sort of step in a major way, because they realized they had to do so to sustain the economy, which was in peril. But there's always been this kind of, and that's gone on into our own time of President Reagan firing the PATCO strikers. And again, it's always a little give and take, some presidents being a little more friendly, but largely a kind of a hands-off attitude. In many ways, that's been vexing to organized labor.
And so when you look at this in terms of both political leadership and what has transpired, and you note in your book that the United States is somewhat unique, especially among the West, in that big business organized so much to resist the movement to protect workers more than other places in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you think ultimately that is?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think it was because the government itself, unlike some European countries, there was no strong central government at the time that the first large capital was organized. And so corporations sort of got a head start on flexing their might. Secondly, I think there's just something in the American ethos, sort of a preference for the individual, distrust of collective entities, and particularly the idea of workers' collectives. I think that's an important point. In other words, you know, labor unions are not like Cub Scout groups or church choirs or book clubs. They're organizations that are seeking economic and social reforms, and they have the power of the strike. And that's a very powerful thing, and threatening to not only companies, but even in a certain way to the American way of thinking, the idea that a man's business is something not to be interfered with, an individual should be making it on their own, and so that a labor union is a kind of a necessary evil at best. And, of course, we see this attitude even today. I mean, as we know, a lot of people have negative views of labor unions. Partly, I think it is this sense that there's something alien about it. You know, it's communistic. It's not American. It's not something that fits here, where each person finds their own destiny and makes it their own way.
So let's walk through some of the stories that you tell in your book, in There Is Power in a Union. You start out with the story about Lowell.
Well, Lowell was an amazing story. In other words, I mentioned earlier about how the founders, Jefferson and Hamilton, differed about whether we wanted industrialization here. They had seen what had happened in Europe and England. The mills there was a very kind of a sordid scene with workers living in slums and hovels, and Jefferson in particular thought America should remain largely an agricultural country. Hamilton and others differed and thought, oh no, we can have both. We have so many natural resources here. So eventually industry did come to America. It was really the first large industrialization occurred in New England in the textile mills. And what you're referring to is what they came to call the Lowell Miracle. It was centered around Lowell, Massachusetts. And you had young farm girls coming from New Hampshire and other parts of New England to work in these mills. And, you know, for about a generation, you had a successful working arrangement between capital and these workers. Great pains were taken. Of course, it was very paternalistic. The young girls, they lived in boarding houses that had these kind of moral den mothers in charge of them. And the idea was that America would do a much better job, simply because it was America, than Europe or England in managing this relationship between workers and capital. Inevitably, what happened, though, is after about a generation, the young women got older. They realized they were working 12 and 14 hours a day and didn't like it. They didn't like the foul air in the mills and so on. They weren't organized, but they began to turn out, as they would say. They didn't use the term strike then. You know, they just would march out of the factory, demand higher wages, better hours, and so on. And really, that was the first issue. It was over hours. Wages were not really the first issue that kind of brought workers into labor organizations. It had to do with shortening the hours of work, which were seen as inhumane. And so first you had a 10-hour movement, and later that became the famous 8-hour movement. basically workers had a strong argument too, which was they said, well, we want to be good citizens, and we want to be able to go to church on Sunday and to educate ourselves so we can vote, and we can't do that if we're working 12 and 14 hours a day. And that proved to be a very compelling argument across the country because, of course, people thought, well, that makes sense. I mean, if you're an American. So it was a way of kind of finding a weak point in the corporation's treatment of workers and pushing against that.
One of the things I thought was quite interesting in that chapter, and then I saw a pattern sort of emerge in your book, which was there were these publications written by the workers. And in Lowell, there was one that began, I think it was called the Lowell Offering. And it was what started to expose the unhappiness among the women that were working there.
I was just going to say, yes, the Lowell Offering is an amazing story in that it was a literary journal written and edited by the young women who worked in the mills. And it was the first periodical edited by women in America, and it started out during the kind of salad days of labor in the textile mills of New England, and many of the articles had to do with the benefits of wage labor for young women who previously had worked unpaid on farms. Of course, there were many salutary things about it, and a lot of the articles focused on the new opportunities available to these young women. But then, of course, what happened is the Lowell Offering itself then became somewhat of a forum for women to complain about the harsh conditions of labor in the mills. And eventually, some of the women who had worked on the Lowell Offering went on to found more radical journals having to do with labor issues in New England. And so there was a kind of a matriculation onto much more intense and bothersome issues.
And overall, how important do you think the labor publications were?
Well, I think in their day they were very important because one thing you have to remember is that the whole idea of like worker consciousness was a new concept. And so disseminating it was all important. And what you saw, particularly around the time of the Civil War and after, was very urgent sense on the part of early labor reformers that the word needed to be spread. In other words, that many of these people, I'm thinking of a man named William Silvis, who was an iron molder and an organizer and one of the first leaders of a national labor federation. And these people had a kind of almost religious conviction that if something was not done, if workers were not organized in a way that would match the degree of organization enjoyed by capital, you know, that all hope was lost, essentially. And so there was a fervency to it. It's sort of remarkable when you read about it. These people wrote very vigorous articles. They traveled widely by hook or by crook any way they could, almost in a kind of Johnny Appleseed-like way, going across the country, basically spreading the gospel. You know, brothers and sisters, we have to organize. Otherwise, we're just going to wind up sort of ground up in the machinery of large industry. So those kind of journals were extremely important, as were the activities of a lot of these reformers who sort of pounded the pavement in a way to get out there and spread the word.
So then you go on to tell a story of shoemakers in Lynn, Massachusetts, 20,000 of them who went on strike for 3 months. You said this was the longest work stoppage in pre-Civil War America. What led to it and what happened?
Well, that's a good example. The shoe strike of Lynn of 1860 is justifiably famous because it was the first large-scale work stoppage, as you say. And you saw this many places in America at the time, but especially New England. Basically, what that was about was the transition from a kind of what they called the journeyman system of work, of a sort of master, apprentice, journeyman, either working out of one's home or a barn or in a very small factory, to create a kind of local industry. In Lynn, it was the making of shoes. Lynn, Massachusetts, was the shoemaking capital of 19th century America. Well, what happened is, of course, capital came in and began organizing larger factories. This was abetted by the introduction of the sewing machine, which is a new technology. So overnight, you had the local industry changed. You then had women and men coming in from other communities to sit at these sewing machines and work in factories, thus upsetting many of the traditions of work in this community. The strike was about the both the home workers, as they were called, and the factory workers, basically getting together and agreeing that they had to do something to keep basically a living wage viable, given all these changes that were going on in terms of the magnitude of industry and the speed with which they were expected to work. So the Lynn strike was a big one in that you had a huge walkout. You began seeing protest marches involving 10, 15, 20,000 people, which were sort of unheard of, in a sense, in the pre-Civil War America. Another interesting thing about Lynn that I found is that it was probably the first labor dispute that attracted national press attention. In other words, you had journalists arriving from various other cities along the Eastern Seaboard to cover the strike, and it was this kind of wonderful early incubator, in a way, of this relationship between the press and labor, capital. You, of course, had police involved. There were several street dust-ups over this, people marching through downtown Lynn. The strike itself ended sort of anticlimax. In other words, there was a rough compromise worked out. The unions weren't really recognized. But it was a very important moment. It was a kind of a glimpse of what was to come, sort of a seeing labor organized on a kind of large scale, willing to take to the streets and to have enough solidarity to stay out of work and to force capital's hand a bit.
Now, back to Abraham Lincoln, who was, of course, a Republican who supported labor organizing at the time, seemed to be on the side of working people. Labor then rewarded him. They enlisted. Talk about the workers and the Civil War and the relationship between the labor struggle, the president, and slavery.
In the New England mills in particular, which is where industry was based in the pre-Civil War era, there had always been this odd tension because, of course, the textiles relied on slave cotton from the South. And so there had been this argument ever since the 1830s about wage slaves in the North and real slaves, actual slaves in the South, and the fact that the Northern wage workers were using a slave-made product. So there had been this kind of sensitivity to it all along. And when you had a union-friendly president like Lincoln, and you had this basic issue of slavery in the South, slave labor, it was very much a motivating factor, not for all Northern workers, but for a lot. And so it organized around this issue of land. People would have land, they would be able to work as free men, and they would be able to be literally free to vote their conscience. This was the slogan, in a sense, of the early Republican Party. This was a very powerful and compelling political program, and it helped to generate the origins of the Republican Party. And then, of course, during the Civil War itself, sometimes entire unions would enlist as like a regiment. In other words, they would remain together. They would go off to war as, say, the Boilermakers or the Iron Molders of Cincinnati or something, actually march off together. So it was a very solidifying kind of effect, and many of them came out of the Civil War. The Union then were, of course, their bonds were strengthened by having gone through this kind of forge of war themselves. So, yes, the Civil War played a very pivotal role in establishing many of these unions and giving them a kind of national profile.
We saw a big financial panic in the 1870s, and we saw a lot of very poor people. Some said many were just relegated to permanent poverty. And then we start hearing the communist fear again. Talk about how this all shaped American presence.
You mentioned the panic of 1873. Whenever you have a harsh economic environment, that's when often labor strife appears as well, because it's often the workers who are pinched and laid off. And what you had in the late 19th century that was unique, in a sense, was that you often had solidarity organization between the unemployed and workers. Because in those days in particular, workers saw very little difference between themselves and those who were unemployed. In an era when there was no unemployment insurance, very little in the way of any kind of security for workers, everybody realized that they were just one payday away from the same kind of destitution that they might see their neighbor and their family experiencing. That created, though, a much greater sort of force for expressing this dissatisfaction. And that in itself created fears among the rest of the population of communistic influence, sort of a mobs from the slums. And of course, this was not entirely unrealistic because, you know, you have to remember in those days when you were out of a job, you were really down and out. I mean, there was no safety net. There was no FDIC. There was nothing for you. In a sense, people would end up sleeping on the floors of police precincts at best. For instance, at the Tompkins Square in New York, the riot of 1874 was prominent in that it happened shortly after the Paris Commune of 1871, and you had the fears among New Yorkers that this workers' revolt, people of the unemployed and workers in New York, was American expression of this same communistic impulse, and the newspapers would even call them communards. And so this fear, of course, itself then triggered harsh reaction on the part of police, and government, federal troops, etc., to sort of suppress and quell labor unrest, particularly in urban areas. So it did two things. It helped to create this permanent sense of this permanent rift between capital and the scruffy masses. At the same time, it also triggered among a lot of Americans the idea that some reforms were necessary because this couldn't possibly be the society that we wanted to have. You began to see a proliferation of writings and speeches about the need to deal with poverty in slums and children living in poverty, going without food or what have you. Those are many things that then kind of led up to the progressive era that we associate with, say, the beginning in the 1890s or so, and leading on into the 20th century and many of the improvements of industrial democracy.
And then you've got the emergence of some of the really well-known names for people who are historians like you that some people are forgetting today. We had people like Samuel Gompers, we had Justice Schwab, we had Emma Goldman.
One thing that happened, as I mentioned, there were these kind of different reactions, and that happened within the labor movement itself because you had someone like Samuel Gompers. He'd been a cigar maker in New York. He reacted to this kind of radicalization of labor by saying, this can't be the way to go. In other words, if we act like angry activists all the time, taking to the streets, we're always going to be marginalized and treated as the enemy. What we need to do is be organized and kind of keep a cool head and learn how to negotiate and deal with business, you know, to sit down at the table with them and make our demands, but do so in a way in which they can't describe us or characterize us as too difficult to deal with, or rather that they want to just confront us at the barricades. So you have the Gompers, and of course this morphed into an organization which he helped found, the American Federation of Labor, which became, over many years, the leading labor organization in America. At the same time, you had others who sort of took the challenge more literally. These were anarchists, socialists. They took all kinds of different names. We associate labor organizations with them, such as the IWW, the Wobblies, organizations that instead rejected the entire capitalist model and wanted to replace it with something different, more enlightened and more humane. They disparaged people like Gompers, who they saw as more milquetoasty, willing to meet corporations on middle ground. So that split as well then would characterize the labor struggle in America for about the next half century at least.
Well, let's talk about the Wobblies. They were very important. They were definitely demonized during the Red Scare. Mm-hmm. Talk about them, why they mattered, and what happened to them, and what you think the effect has been.
They're one of the most colorful stories in American labor history in that they came about as a convergence of the sort of Eastern radicals associated with the Lower East Side of New York, people like Emma Goldman and many, many others who were involved, Justice Schwab, who you mentioned, as well as the Western Federation of Miners, which were a kind of militant miners union from out west, who had developed a kind of radical, tough style, really by necessity, because in the West, in mining communities, in particular in America, historically, the reaction, partly this is because of the isolation, the physical isolation of mine communities, it's always been very, very violent, and bosses and workers alike have often gone at each other with guns and bombs, and almost in some cases you've had these, you know, really sort of like guerrilla wars going on. And so the Western Federation of Miners were a very tough breed. When they hooked up with the Eastern sort of intellectuals and radicals of New York, Boston, Cleveland, and so on, it made a very, very dynamic organization. One thing about the Wobblies is they were open to everybody. They were not, unlike other unions, they were not focused on a particular trade. Anyone could join. You could be an immigrant right off the boat. You may not speak English. That was okay. Men, women, blacks, anyone could join the Wobblies, and many, many did. And it became this kind of really more than just a labor union. It was really more of a social movement. Of course, the funny irony about the Wobblies is that they spread a kind of utopian gospel. At the same time, their actual impact turned out to be in areas that were maybe not really anticipated. One is they staged many valiant free speech battles throughout, especially in the West in the early years of the 20th century, because they demanded the right to organize and to get up in the city square and make speeches about work and conditions in mines. And when the police tried to tell them they couldn't make these speeches, the Wobblies insisted they could, and many went to jail. And so this became a kind of a side issue, in a sense, on itself, which turned out to be very critical because they were fighting for a very germane American right. The other thing they did that was sort of, again, not expected is they turned out to be very good organizers. So, for instance, the Bread and Roses strike of 1912 up in Lawrence, Mass., which involved huge textile mills, the Wobblies went in. You had about 15 different immigrant groups. They barely understood one another because they spoke so many languages. The Wobblies were the only organization in America that actually could go in and have the patience to make sense of all this. And they did so wonderfully. They went in and organized with relief efforts that they managed on their own, et cetera, to keep this sprawling community of textile workers from all the different ethnicities to actually stay out of work for about 6 or 8 weeks and to stare down the American Woolen Company, which was this huge textile corporation. And they won. And so the Bread and Roses strike was a very, again, a very pivotal event to kind of establish the idea that immigrant workers could not be endlessly exploited. They would and could organize effectively. So the Wobblies, in a sense, for all their kind of wild, theatrical reputation, proved to be on the ground very good labor organizers. The one last thing I'll say about them, as you mentioned, is that because they did frighten people, they were targeted by the Wilson administration and also, of course, during the Red Scare, the Palmer Raids of 1919, and very much decimated at that time, the leaders arrested and given harsh prison sentences. Several of them just went into exile rather than go into a federal penitentiary. So the Wobblies have this interesting arc. They really kind of bridged the 19th and 20th centuries, and I think deserve their reputation as being one of the more dynamic labor organizations in American history.
And among one of the more famous Wobblies, of course, is where you got the title of the book, There's Power in a Union, and that is Joe Hill.
There's Power in a Union is a song written by Joe Hill. Joe Hill was a Swedish worker, a sort of itinerant worker of the early 20th century, and he wound up in Salt Lake City where he was accused of being involved in the murder of a grocer and his son. And it's a case that no one has ever really solved. It appeared that there wasn't a lot of evidence against Joe Hill that wasn't sort of circumstantial in nature. Joe Hill himself, for a long time, refused to even really mount a defense of himself. And, of course, the atmosphere at that time in those communities out west was so vehemently anti-Wobbly that, of course, was very much prejudiced against him. He was executed. But he was a well-known songwriter, and so upon his death, he became one of the best-known labor martyrs. And many of his songs, of course, are known to us. He's kind of stands as sort of the example of a labor martyr willing to embrace his ideas all the way to the grave.
Another important person in labor that a lot of people don't know her history was Mother Jones, Mary Mother Jones.
Mm-hmm.
She had lost her kids and husband in a yellow fever epidemic. Tell us her story and the fruits of her labor.
Yeah, Mother Jones is another amazing character. As you say, she was an Irish immigrant. She'd been a school teacher. She lost her husband and 4 children in a yellow fever epidemic in Memphis right after the Civil War. She then moved to Chicago, which Chicago was really kind of a hotbed of labor activism in the 1870s and 1880s, of course, culminating with the Haymarket riot of 1886, when the plea for an 8-hour day wound up with a bombing in which several policemen were killed. It was never really proven who threw the bomb, but leading anarchists were rounded up and tried, and eventually several of them were executed. And this, again, too, was seen as a kind of a, the trial itself was more or less a travesty of justice. These men were very much sort of marched to the gallows almost from the moment they were taken into custody. And people like Mother Jones tended to be radicalized by this event. Of course, many other stimuli that would have done that as well. But by the 1880s, 1890s, she'd become very much almost a full-time labor radical. And she began being involved. She was called the miner's angel. She would go from one mining community to another, assisting. Her focus was a lot on mobilizing families, which was an interesting approach and kind of endeared her to people because she wasn't just focused on the men who were going down the mine, but also on their wives and children and trying to motivate them to become involved and looking out for their interests. She's also well known for fighting for reform in the area of child labor. She staged a march from Philadelphia to New York in 1903 to march to the home of President Teddy Roosevelt to demand that he do something about the fact that 7- and 8-year-old children were working in textile mills in the Philadelphia area and being kept out of school, obviously, too. So she became kind of identified with that issue, the mining issue and also the children's labor reform. And she was really ahead of her time. She helped to kind of introduce this idea into American society that children had no business working in a factory. They should be in school. They should be allowed to play. They needed time to grow up, basically, before they would be expected to go to work. She had what we would call, I guess, a sort of in-your-face style of organizing. She was a very petite woman. I don't think she even was 5 feet tall. And she was sort of well-known for confronting the powers that be and demanding that they recognize their own humanity, basically, and treat workers and their families better. And she became justifiably famous. She lived to be in her 90s and was and is today still, of course, recognized as something of a legend.
Yeah, and most of her activism, as I understand, was while she was in her 70s.
Yeah, that's true. She was a late bloomer, I guess, in a way. It wasn't until really 1894, you know, the time of Coxey's army. There was a man named Jacob Coxey who staged a march on Washington in 1894 from Ohio, basically demanding the New Deal about half a century before it came to fruition. You know, relief, the creation of jobs, Social Security, unemployment insurance. And Mother Jones got involved with that, helping to lead a column toward Washington. I think she was probably in her late 50s by then. By the early 20th century, she was already an older woman. And, of course, she used that to great advantage. That was part of her power, was that she looked like a Mother Superior, who was somebody's grandmother. So, of course, it was difficult, in a sense, for police or authorities to mistreat her or ignore her because she was very persistent. And really, despite her appearance, of course, she was one very tough woman and not only lay into the bosses, but she was also known for hectoring the workers. You know, one of Mother Jones, if you go back and look at her speeches, it's amazing. She would insult the manhood, basically, of miners. Anyone she thought who was being lax about defending their own rights, she just had no patience for. And so she was a wonderful sort of an engine, really, in a sense, going around and really lighting a fire under a lot of not only intimidating bosses, but also getting workers off their behind, helping to lead them in confronting authority.
And the other thing I thought was really interesting about her, and then we can move on, is that she really didn't have a permanent home. She wandered. She moved around.
Right. She appeared before Congress. They said, "Where do you live?" And she said, "I have no fixed address. Wherever there's a struggle, that's where I live." She said it more eloquently, but she was kind of itinerant in a sense. And she drifted in and out of the Socialist Party, I believe, for some years. And someone who really was a product of her times, in a sense. And a fascinating story. She lived such a long time, too, that in a way her own life story, if you read it, it becomes this kind of really a history of organized labor in America.
Now, do you have a sense that we have had today any leaders like a Mother Jones?
Well, definitely. Someone like Cesar Chavez, for instance, out in California with the fruit workers, migrant farm workers, his movement is something that was very inspired and also of its time. In other words, I talked earlier about labor finding ways to kind of make use of trends and sort of the current atmosphere, the zeitgeist, if you can. What he did is he basically looked at Martin Luther King and the success of the civil rights movement in the South in the 60s and emulated that. The farm workers were a nonviolent movement of solidarity. They used the consumer boycott, protest, sit-ins, picketing, and that was a very much, you know, the influence of Gandhi, Thoreau, Martin Luther King, and Chavez was the first person to really adapt that to labor, the labor struggle. He's certainly a person who was incredibly instrumental in kind of changing tactics to suit the present day. And there have been others. Someone like Walter Reuther was someone I came away admiring a lot. He was the president of the United Auto Workers for many years. And he and his brothers, Roy and Victor, were involved in the introduction of the sit-down strike in the 1930s in the auto plants in Flint, Michigan, which again transformed the labor movement, the idea of occupying the factory in which you work and just sitting, they called it sitting on your job, proved to be totally thwarted the authorities and the police because you had the workers inside the factory. You couldn't use violence to dislodge them for fear of damaging the factory. There was something just in terms of publicity, it generated a lot of sympathy among the public at large, the idea of workers defending their own place of work from those who might dislodge them from it. I tend to be optimistic about it, but I think that when workers are put upon enough, they will tend to organize in their own behalf, and inevitably there is someone or different people who will come to the fore to serve as their spokesman or leaders, inspiration. And I just think that's a kind of a recurring trend. You see that throughout American history and American labor history.
So then there was a decline. So there was a golden age of labor, and then there was a decline. What do you see as the pivotal factors that really brought labor down a bit? Because now we see kind of a weak labor movement.
Oh, yeah, no, definitely. I mean, the high point of labor, organized labor, in a sense, came after the Second World War into the 1950s. I think there were many factors involved. It had to do with, of course, the change of work itself away from centralized industrial centers. I mean, obviously, it's much easier to mount a labor movement when you have workers congregating, working in the same town. It's hard for us even to picture, in a sense, what some of these communities were like. A place like Pittsburgh, say, in the early 20th century, with tens of thousands of workers present in close proximity, their union halls right down the block from where they worked. When you compare that to how we live today with suburban sprawl, people driving many miles to their job, it's just a much different picture. And, of course, you also had technology, which changed the nature of work itself away from kind of industry and manufacturing to more of a service economy. And then, of course, you had resistance, the Taft-Hartley Law of 1947, which was a reaction to the New Deal on the part of conservatives to basically thwart unions. They felt unions were getting too powerful. They made it more difficult for unions to organize politically, to use their political might. This is an argument we still see today, the question of how unions are to be organized. In other words, how are they elected? Who recognizes them? All these things have always been in flux. Some of those, that capability has been weakened over the years. And let's not forget also, unions have stumbled themselves. I think one mistake in the mid-20th century was unions more or less embraced Cold War in a very fulsome way, and they tended to expunge their own, the more radical aspects of the labor movement, or what they perceived that to be. In other words, they were policing themselves a little bit, and I think it was a little sort of self-defeating, in a sense, to begin trying to marginalize the more activist elements in the labor movement. You also saw labor becoming sort of big business in its orientation, losing touch with the rank and file. You now had people like George Meany, who were kind of remote from more sort of workers who were, you know, showing up every morning on the assembly lawn. And so you have this kind of even a change in the character of unions. And then finally, of course, recently we have to look at globalization, which has been, in a way, devastating to unions, obviously, because it puts American workers in competition with workers all around the world who are non-unionized and have no protection and will work for much lower wages. And so when you see American jobs disappearing to those countries, then that obviously leaves American labor in a very difficult position. And since labor organizing is almost always about leverage, when you don't have leverage, you have a much steeper hill to climb. You know, in a sense, that has been very injurious to labor over the past decade or so, past 20 years even. And that's really where things are at. And so you see if people are not quite sure, that people have lost confidence in unions to a certain extent. They hear sensational stories about corruption in unions, and there's an inclination of, you know, I think much more than is deserved, there's an inclination to believe that unions are not serving a valid purpose anymore. That you see that even recently. I've been amazed, I'm sure a lot of people have, at how readily this idea that unions and their pensions are creating a financial disaster and what have you. And I think that story, you know, as we've seen, it's been carried much too far. But that's the kind of thing that can happen when you have an atmosphere where unions are not respected and people don't really recognize the valuable role they play in society.
Where do you see workers' movements going?
That's sort of the question of the hour. I think in a certain way that we have yet to see what that's going to be. I mean, the good news is I think labor, for many years, I think labor was sort of asleep at the wheel. I do think it has awakened in the last 10 or 15 years. It's much more focused on organizing again, and it's also focusing on how to work on an international basis. And, of course, that's one thing I think that's really pivotal right now is because capital has gone global. The question is whether labor can. You know, as I said, labor has historically transformed itself at pivotal moments. But whether it can do so now, it's an immense challenge. What it is doing is you do see labor already working in cooperation with non-labor organizations, such as anti-sweatshop leagues, human rights groups, and environmental organizations, because what they see is that all these issues are really unified. When you're talking about labor in a developing country, you're also talking about exploitation of the environment, human rights abuses, and this kind of thing. And so labor has learned to sort of transform itself, in other words, to use what leverage they can. And that often suggests a new type of labor or organizing as we go forward. Labor organizing is something that is a universal, it's a universal concept. I can't imagine it would ever completely go away. I think anywhere people are working for wages, they will ultimately turn to their collective might to resist what they see as injustice on the part of the bosses. And so I do think it's something that I don't know exactly what form it will take. I do think it's something that will always be with us. And we'll just have to kind of wait and see. I think it'll be another decade or so before we get a better picture of that.
Well, Philip Dre, I'd like to thank you very much for being with us. The book, again, is called There is Power in a Union, The Epic Story of Labor in America. Thank you so very much.
Thanks for having me.
And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at @Armudian, and we'll see you next week.
If we want to see...